So I might as well get started. Actually, I thought I would deviate slightly from our usual approach and finish off diffraction, vector diffraction theory, a bit differently, and just go through it because there's like lots of trig and algebraic derivations, and I don't think you really want me to drag you through all those trig identities. So I thought I would just go through that part of chapter 10 on the PowerPoint, well, PDF. Would you feel cheated if I don't write all the equations out on the board? Okay, but I'll go back to the usual style lecture when we start chapter 11, which so this might take, I'm not sure, 10 or 15 minutes to finish off vector diffraction theory. So we had already covered using formulas like this for scalar diffraction theory, where you write the electric field and you're usually thinking of coming in often to a plane, although we set up some other geometries, but like a plane with some apertures in it, and there would be the electric field, which in this integral, this is really an integral equation over the apertures. But usually you make the kind of Born or perturbative approximation that you approximate the E and the integrals by the incident fields. And so basically, if we specialize to that situation, which is around where I ended last time, and look only in the far zone, which is where you're usually the most interested, although you can, of course, apply all that in the near or intermediate zones as well. You get a formula for the integral over the incident field and an e to the minus ik dot x prime with n cross, the incident field. And then you get the usual e to the ikr over r, the spherical waves expanding and falling off like 1 over r. And we had a geometry to treat a concrete case, a circular aperture, which is, I think, actually section 10.9 in Jackson. So we are going to have an incident wave coming in at and the plane containing the circle aperture will be set in the xy plane. Then we have x have to integrate over all the little area elements of the circle with area elements dA prime and set up all the geometry for that. So we have to choose concrete coordinates. We'll say the incident wave vector is in the xz plane, forming a cosine, an angle alpha between the x and z axes, so alpha relative to the z axis. And then we'll consider a linearly polarized incident radiation orthogonal to that in this direction, minus z hat sine alpha plus x hat cos alpha for the polarization vector. Now, so this is our full incident electric field, taking the k dot r in the incident direction and writing the electric field. And we need n hat cross that. N hat, you recall, is the normal directed into the side you're going to observe the photons. So n hat cross that n hat will be in the z direction orthogonal to the plane. So that will kill off the cross product, will kill off the z component, and you'll just be left with a y component in the cross product. So, as you might expect, we would set up the integral in polar coordinates over the circle and get these complicated looking exponents where all the angles appear. The theta and phi will be the angles of observation. The phi prime and theta prime, or sorry, phi prime and rho prime are what you're integrating over. And there are simplifications in the exponent. If you kind of write that, realize there is a one term multiplying here cos phi prime and one term multiplying sine phi prime, but it involves this complicated combination of the incident angle and the observation angles. That it's kind of simplifies things if we regard rewrite this as like a function a times cos phi prime plus b sine phi prime, and we can then put this into a little more compact notation and write this as cosine of phi prime minus capital phi, and this capital phi you define as, you know, the arctangent of the ratio of those two terms. And then there's this amplitude as well you have to carry through. Okay, so this becomes this integral, and that will jump out at you as a Bessel function integral, pretty well-known integral. And so you get this formula for the electric field as an outgoing spherical wave, e to the ikr over r, a squared e naught cos alpha, k hat cross y hat still is there, and then the Bessel function of ka in this amplitude xc we had just defined divided by ka xc. And then the magnetic field will be the cross product with E over Z naught. So we're interested in the time averaged pointing vector R squared S. So we'll take the cross product of E conjugate with H and take the real part. And now you get the sort of standard multiple cross and dot products that are just so common in E&M, and we've all learned to come to know and love these formulas. But you can then put in the actual geometry, and it all comes down, fairly simple expression after just a little bit of trig, to sine squared theta cos squared phi for the spherical polar angles of the detector. And then what you're interested in usually would be the differential time average diffracted power per unit solid angle, which is this formula. And Jackson says it's a good idea to rewrite it in terms of the incident power coming in normal to the aperture plane, which is this absolute E naught squared over 2Z naught pi a squared cosine alpha. And in that language, it looks like this. And the main thing to point out about this, I think, is that it's going to be very sharply peaked at short wavelengths. You might worry about this having possible divergences when this KAXC gets small. But actually, you shouldn't, because J1 is proportional to KAXC when KAXC is small. So this will become some constant in that limit. So anyway, and just thinking about the short wavelength limit, come in at some angle alpha, then you're going to be very sharply peaked around a very small range of angles centered around alpha. in that limit, like you would expect from geometrical optics in that limit. And you can compare that with the scalar diffraction theory, and it looks pretty different, but as Jackson points out, it actually looks pretty similar. It'd be a little bit difficult to tell apart the vector theory from the scalar theory, but if you're really interested in all the polarization details, then you're better off doing the vector diffraction theory. All these have this problem with the Kirchhoff approximation that they are intrinsically inconsistent. But again, seems like within the typical accuracy you're looking for in these calculations, it's good enough. At least that is my sense from our favorite tome. Okay, I think that's all I want to say about chapter 10. Any questions about vector diffraction theory? So, on to special relativity. Oh, I could have left up the slide one more time. But maybe I'll remind you that now that we are in chapter 11, Jackson changes to Gaussian units. Where E and B have the same units, for instance, and there's no epsilon naught and mu naught floating around in Maxwell's equations, you just see the speed of light. And you have weird units for things like charge, stat coulombs. Have you ever heard of stat coulombs? Anyway, you have to, if you really want to convert a formula that you love and know in SI units, Jackson has a really very clear appendix that shows how to do the conversion. Okay, so special relativity. Let's talk about Albert Einstein. He was a pretty cool guy, pretty smart, they tell me, although he never got quite quantum mechanics, never quite really got the idea. Kind of sad, but anyway, he had a lot of good ideas, but I don't think he ever quite caught on to the quantum world. So, what did he do? He postulated, well, we can... Of course, he thought a lot. But we kind of boil down his thinking. He used to think, I think he claimed even as a child, he would try to imagine what it's like to ride along with a light beam. What would it look like? What would that be like? And out of that thinking, he developed relativity. Of course, around the same time, Michelson and Morley were finding that the speed of light did not seem to, you know, show the existence of an ether field moving along, that all the velocities should be relative to But apparently he wasn't paying that much attention to the Michelson-Morley experiment, and really developed these ideas completely independently. That's my understanding anyway. So now we recast all this and we sort of start, kind of boil down what Einstein did to two postulates. First, I mean, these are really simple. I could just tell them to you, but let me write them because they're so important. The laws of physics are the same in all inertial reference frames, meaning non-accelerated, okay, that seems almost too obvious to bother writing down, but we've got to say it. Amazingly simple first postulate. The second also seems simple to state, although profoundly surprising at the time. Speed of light in vacuum, which we use the letter C to indicate, is the same in every inertial frame. And experiments tested this over the years, to many digits. I think speed of light was known already from maybe studying the motion of the moons of Jupiter, at least back to those days, maybe in the 1700s. I'm not sure exactly when. They already had a fairly reasonable speed of light at that time. Of course, with lasers and so on, you can make this more and more accurate. And eventually, everyone was always finding the same, just getting more digits. And so finally, it was declared to be no longer even a measured quantity, that our entire system of units became based on this. And it's now a defined fundamental constant. Namely, 299,792,458 meters per second. I'm sorry, that's not in Gaussian units. Okay, very easy to state postulate, but with profound implications, and very surprising. So let's look at least a couple of the elementary derivations of special relativity. I think I'm sure you have all encountered that in your undergraduate work, if not graduate work already. But to me, one of the most dramatic is the idea of time dilation. I mean, without relativity, all these fancy accelerators built around the world, they wouldn't work. Their very design hinges on time dilation. And I'll show you some examples of that. So, we're going to imagine measuring a time interval between two events. Okay. And we have to do that rather carefully. And we're going to measure it in one inertial reference frame. Well, let me just say in any inertial reference frame. And I'll call that inertial reference frame K. And to do that, because two events like what? Hearing a train whistle at one time and then maybe a minute later at another time. The train might be standing still in one reference frame, but it might be moving in another reference frame. And so they might or might not appear, these two events, at the same location. So to set this up in general, we have to introduce a set of synchronized clocks. This had to be stated and explained really carefully in Einstein's time. Now we have GPS satellites up here, constellation. So they are pretty easily giving you a set of synchronized clocks, at least on the surface of the Earth, if you allow me to pretend that that's an inertial reference frame, which is okay for most purposes. But what you had to imagine in Einstein's time was that, you know, there was a committee of people who each had their clocks. They all got together at the start of the week or day, and they all compared their little clocks, made sure they were all on the same time, and they're all in the same inertial reference frame. Or in this train example, there would be all the people on the train moving at the same velocity would have their set of synchronized clocks. So in any case, if measurements do occur of two events at two different locations, the committee can get together, compare their times, and say, what was the time difference in their frame between the two events? So that had to be stated pretty explicitly and maybe pedantically. Okay, so we're going to do a really simple experiment in reference frame K at first, and then we'll consider the same experiment from the point of view of a different inertial reference frame. Okay, so let's consider a light box that is stationary in reference frame K. Which works as follows. In frame K, the picture of the events that you've got an observer here right next to this light box, which is basically has a source of light and there is a mirror at the top. And so what we're going to do, and we're going to set up some length. We'll call the height or length of the box L. Right, so there is going to be a flash at time zero. Boom. Firecracker goes off or something. At a very well-defined time. Sending out the photons. Some are going to go up and reflect and come back. And a second event will be the click of the photon. Okay, so this is event one. Let me just draw that. It's just the light pulse going off, sending out the photons. And now event two, which is happening at the same location, but I'm going to draw it over here, is the receipt of the photon in a detector that makes a click at time T. I guess I'm using capital T. All right, so by simple kinematics, takes time L over C to get up to the mirror, another time L over C to come back down. So the time duration between these two events is 2L over C to this observer standing next to the light box that is stationary in his or her frame. Okay, so that's how K sees these events. And now we're going to imagine the same two events to an observer flying past observer K in a spaceship. Einstein would have picked a train, but I like spaceships. Okay, so always challenges my drawing abilities. Let me try. Okay, so how are these events as a spaceship flies by? And I'll imagine for the first event, when the flash goes off, just the front of the spaceship is near the flash. Something like that. And this is moving at velocity v relative to k. And I'll call the inertial reference frame attached to the spaceship, I'll call reference frame k prime is the spaceship people or aliens. That'd be more fun. What would the aliens say happened? Okay, so let's synchronize our clocks and just say that the time of the flash is going to be called T prime equals zero by the people on the spaceship. Then at an intermediate time, a later intermediate time, right, when the spaceship has moved a ways, the photon hits the mirror. As I've drawn it, it's some ways away, so the people on the spaceship probably don't see that event, but the spaceship will have moved some distance. At that time when that happened, and then but they will see the photon coming back and being detected, at some time when the spaceship has gone farther, and is maybe here when the click occurs, at a time we will call T prime, or actually I'll call that capital T prime, when the click occurs as measured by the spaceship. Okay, so to the people on the spaceship, these events looked a little different. Photon didn't just go up and down in one dimension, right? To the people in the spaceship, if we think of a moving time axis, then at the first time when the click went off, or sorry, the flash went off, happened at one. Why did I draw it that way? I guess I'm drawing it in space, not in time. Okay, right. So let me draw the spaceship where the events happened, right? So right, yeah, in terms of where on the spaceship they saw the click and everything in the flash, the people, the observers close to the front of the spaceship saw the flash, then there was the intermediate time, and then the people toward the back saw the click. Right. So that was a pretty terrible approximation. So yeah, to the observers on in K prime, it looked like, right, something like this. The photon went up, but also was happening in a moving, in a changing the location of the flash and the click. Okay. And the separation between these would be because the motion is at velocity v, right? The distance between these two events would be vt prime in the horizontal direction, in the direction of the velocity. And again, in the direction orthogonal, it's just the same length L. Okay. So the K prime observers say that the time between these two events, the flash and the click, is going to be T prime, which will be, if you use the Pythagorean theorem for these two right triangles here, it'll be twice the time to do one of these arms. So that's 2 over C times the length of this diagonal, which is L squared plus V T prime over 2 squared to the 1/2. It's the length of the one diagonal arm divided then by the speed of light and multiplied by 2 because it has to traverse both diagonals. Right. Okay, but L squared here, we said, relative to the time of observer K was CT over 2. So if we plug that in and square both sides, we have T prime squared is 4 over C squared t squared over 4 plus v squared t prime squared over 4. And we can solve that equation for t prime in terms of t and get that t prime sees this time between the events t over root 1 minus v squared over c squared. The foundational equation of time dilation. And this is often now also written as gamma t, where gamma is this 1 over root 1 minus v squared over c squared will play an important role in the whole discussion. Okay, so that's a surprising but profound implication of special relativity. Now, totally verified experimentally. Because we can make particles go very close to the speed of light now, like muons at Fermilab. So, well, it's popular to say in popular magazines, everything is relative, okay? So one person sees one thing, another person sees something different. But how do we decide which person sees the shorter time or the longer time? Okay. Well, there is something special about two events that is really important to keep track of. There will always be one inertial reference frame where the interval between two events is the shortest. It will always be in the inertial frame where both events occur at the same location. And that's a really important concept. If you're trying to figure out, okay, it seemed like there were these two events. One of them saw a longer time than the other. Okay, how do you tell them apart? Okay. That is where they happen at the same location. So that would be in our reference frame K in this example, because in K prime, the events were observed at different parts of the spaceship. This is such an important concept, it's given a term that is, you have to know, which this shortest possible time is called the proper time. Usually indicated by the Greek letter tau. The proper time between those events. It's the time is measured in the reference frame where they happened at the same place. And all other frames see a later time or a longer time. which is why we call it dilated. So delta t between two events will always be gamma times tau, and gamma is a number always greater than 1 or equal to 1. Okay, that's, I think, the most important. In Fermilab, you have muons produced after some collision of like high energy protons with a chunk of material, lead or something. Okay, so after the collision, boom, 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 out come a stream of muons. They actually have a muon beam at Fermilab. And it's moving pretty close to the speed of light. I forget, maybe gamma is, I forget if it's 1,000 or something like that, but it's a very big number. And they then want to take those muons and collide them with a target, which is quite a ways downstream. And if there was no time dilation, the muons, which only live for, I think, around a microsecond, they would have only gotten to here. But they do the experiment here, which is, I forget, 100 meters downstream or something. So this experiment at Fermilab would just not work if there was no time dilation. So believe it. It's really true. But you can still see people writing crackpot papers. Einstein was wrong! I get those in my email inbox about once a week. Doesn't make any sense! How can that be? Okay, so you can go through the similar derivations of length contraction and such. I'm not going to do that now. I'm going to focus now moving toward understanding the full Lorentz transformation. And of course, eventually we'll see what that does to the electric and magnetic fields and to radiation of charged particles, how all those are affected by relativity. So to move in that direction, I want to first consider maybe the sort of thing Einstein was thinking about, which is, imagine a spherical light pulse. In one reference frame K. And then, of course, we'll consider the same light pulse as seen by K observers in reference frame K prime, moving at velocity V relative to K. Okay, so we're going to imagine, set up an XY axis that will be K, and basically right on top of it at one time will be a y prime x prime axes of observer k prime. And at t and t prime both zero, I'm going to pick their axes to of these frames to coincide at time zero in both frames, a light pulse goes off and sends out photons spherically. And so here's what observer K sees. He sees a pulse of light moving out at time t in all directions equally at equal speeds with a radius ct. Reference frame K and the X and Y axes. Okay. And I'm assuming also maybe that at time zero we have Y and Y prime have been set to zero and Z prime have been set to zero. Okay. So now let's look at K prime C's. Okay, so if reference frame K was here, then it has moved now over here from the point of view of reference frame K at a later time t. But now, relative to this origin, K prime has to also see the light pulse has moved out to a distance of c times t prime at time t prime on its clock. Okay, so both of these, okay, even though I see things going off spherically in my frame where the flash occurred, okay, even this one moving along sees light going out spherically, even though I'm moving along, which seems a little counterintuitive. But constancy of the speed of light implies that. So let's look at the radius of the shell location, the spherical shell of the light pulse. In both frames, right? For K, it looks like C squared T squared determines the radius of that sphere, which is C squared T squared minus X squared minus Y squared minus Z squared is zero. And to K prime, C squared T prime squared minus X prime squared minus Y prime squared minus Z prime squared is zero. And so from this, we're going to set up the relationship between the coordinates in the two frames. Okay. So we'll set this up, we'll call time the zero coordinate. And multiply it by the speed of light so that it also has a length. Okay. So the k coordinates of the spherical light shell our x0 is ct, x1 will be our x position of a point we measure on the light pulse expanding out with time. We'll call x2 the y-axis and x3 the z-axis. And so similarly, k prime has its coordinates x naught prime, which is c times t prime, time it looks at its at the spherical light pulse in its frame, and there will be x1 prime, which will be x prime, x2 prime is y prime, x3 is z prime. And we will now focus on the coordinate parallel to the velocity, which, as I've set it up, I've chosen to be along the x-axis. And part of the reason for that is we either expect or know the dimensions orthogonal to the velocity will not be affected by this Lorentz transformation, which is basically what we are deriving. So in other words, we're expecting y is equal to y prime, z is equal to z prime for this event of light pulse going out to this radius. Okay, so that means what I'm going to assert is that c squared t squared minus x squared then must equal c squared t prime squared minus x prime squared, must hold between the two events. Or x naught squared minus x1 squared in this notation equals x naught prime squared minus x1 prime squared. So our goal in writing it out in this notation is to find the transformation between of coordinates and times between the two frames, which will replace the Galilean transformation, right? Namely between x0 and x1, and x0 prime and x1 prime. And that will be what is now called the Lorentz transformation, which might seem surprising because we're talking about Einstein's work, but one of the interesting ironies of all this was that Lorentz derived these formulas long before Einstein. Trying to understand how Maxwell's equations would transform in different reference frames, I think, was, though he didn't maybe exactly understand what he was doing, Einstein was really the one who put it together conceptually, but the math was actually already there and worked out by Lorentz. Okay, so our expectations. First of all, we expect the transformation to be linear. And we expect that if you replace V by minus V, it should give the inverse transformation. Thank you. Secondly, as we've seen from this light pulse example, there's an invariant in this problem that should be preserved. So the transformation must preserve our invariant. X naught squared minus x1 squared, which has to equal x naught prime squared minus x1 prime squared. Because we proved for a light pulse, this is an invariant. Okay, so I'm going to have what might seem like an odd detour as a kind of an abstract way to derive the mathematics of this transformation. And the way I'm going to find it is I'm going to end up making an analogy with rotation transformations. Okay, so I'm going to first consider an ordinary two-dimensional rotation, because this is a two-dimensional transformation we're looking for. And I'm going to look at it passively. If you remember, the difference between active and passive is if it's active, you grab the vector and you rotate it. Okay. If it's passive, you leave the vector where it is, and you grab the axes and you rotate them. So I'm going to do a passive rotation here. So let's say we have in a coordinate system, first to set up the rotation example, and then I'll benchmark what we learned from that into solving the Lorentz case. We have axes x1 and x2, and let's say there is some vector r to a point P in this frame, and we'll say vector r is at an angle phi relative to the x1 axis. And now I'm going to grab the axes and rotate them through theta. So this will be a new x1 prime axis. This is theta. This will be the new x2 prime axis. And this is theta. And we can use the beloved trigonometry to find the relation of these coordinates. And notice that there will be an invariant in this system, just as there was an invariant in the relativity case. Okay, so let's look at the vectors. So the vector r, we said, is x1, x hat plus x2 y hat, which I can also write as r cos phi x hat plus r sine phi y hat. And I can easily write that in terms of x prime hat and y prime hat as r cosine of lowercase phi minus theta x hat prime plus r sine phi minus theta y hat prime, which I can call x1 prime x x prime hat plus x2 prime y prime hat. Okay. Okay, let me come up here and expanding that out, I can also then write it as r cos phi cos theta plus r sine phi sine theta, breaking up the cosine phi minus theta with the identity x hat prime plus r, and I'll break up the sine cosine minus cosine, or sine phi cos theta plus minus r cos phi sine theta y hat prime. And that is what we're going to equate to x1 cos theta plus x2 sine theta times the vector x hat prime plus minus x1 sine theta plus x2 cos theta y hat prime, which I'm going to rewrite in matrix notation as the transformation 2x2 matrix transforming the coordinates x1 prime, x2 prime. In this rotation example, will be a rotation matrix. It depends on the angle of rotation theta of the axes in this passive rotation to x1, and multiplying the vector x1 and x2, where this r of theta is cos theta sine theta minus sine theta cos theta. It's the simplest 2x2 real orthogonal rotation matrix. And the key I want to stress is that this transformation preserves an invariant, just like our relativity example. Namely, the length of the vector r is not changed. And that means, by analogy to our other example, the invariant says that x1 squared plus x2 squared under this transformation must equal x1 prime squared plus x2 prime squared. And so all this math is very similar to the Lorentz transformation. There is just a different invariant. Right? We have a difference of squares. And I can write that in a suggestive notation as ix0 squared ix0 prime squared plus x1 prime squared has to equal ix0 squared plus x1 squared. This has to relate the coordinates in the two frames. This invariant has to be the same. And this connects with a rotation in our math simply by using an imaginary angle in the rotation matrix. And that will map the rotation math onto the Lorentz transformation math. So if we rotate by an imaginary angle, that would mean we could say theta goes to, I'll say minus I times a sort of angle zeta. That's the Greek letter zeta. Not to be confused with xi, or like most students like to call it in graduate school, squiggle. I call it xi. Okay, so that means basically we can rotate in this imaginary angle sense and get I x naught prime and x1 prime by plugging in minus I zeta for theta. And of course you remember your trig, cosine of I zeta is cosh zeta. And sinh and sine of I zeta is I sinh zeta. So this matrix now looks like cosh zeta minus I sinh zeta, I sinh zeta, cosh zeta. And that multiplies the Ix naught x1 vector. Or to write it out explicitly, the two lines of the two equations, Ix naught prime is I cosh zeta x naught minus I sinh zeta x1, and x1 prime is minus sinh zeta x naught plus cosh zeta x1. And in fact, we can just drop the i's in that first equation everywhere. And so we have now a real transformation between the real time and position coordinates. X0 prime, x1 prime is now cosh zeta minus sinh zeta minus sinh zeta cosh zeta. Oh, when I write fast, it's hard to write zeta. Times x naught x1. And this does indeed obey the preservation of our invariant, x naught prime squared minus x1 prime squared is equal to x naught squared minus x1 squared. And that holds because of the identity cosh squared minus sinh squared is always equal to 1. Okay, so this is all just math, but we have to connect basically achieve our goal of getting the Lorentz transformation by connecting zeta to the physics. And to do this, let's consider the coordinate origin of K prime. Which is x1 prime equals 0, which we relate to the coordinates, x0 minus x0 sinh zeta plus x1 cosh zeta, as I wrote over there. That means x1 over x0 is tanh zeta, but we've already said that then that's x1 over ct over c. I can write it this way, but that's just the velocity of k prime relative to k. And so that is our connection, that our rotation analogy with imaginary angle works if we pick that imaginary angle zeta to be the arc hyperbolic tangent of v over c, which we also write as arc hyperbolic tangent of beta, where beta will be common notation we use a lot in these chapters is v over c. Okay. So we've pretty much got the transformation. Let's write out a few more details about it. Guided by this main fact that there is a similar quadratic invariant in relativity to what you have in rotations. Okay, a few other things to note, which you can check this with your trig. Tan squared of zeta is beta squared, and sinh squared of zeta is equal to beta squared cosh squared zeta. Which is also cosh squared beta minus 1, or sorry, zeta minus 1. And so in our rotation or transformation matrix, cosh zeta is 1 over root 1 minus beta squared. And that is what we called previously gamma. And so sinh of zeta is beta gamma. And so even more simply than using these hyperbolic things, we have a simplest Lorentz transformation for the time and the direction along the relative velocity vector. It's this simple matrix gamma times 1 minus beta 1 times x0, x1. or writing out the equations concretely, x naught prime is gamma times x naught minus beta x1. X1 prime is gamma minus beta x naught plus x1. Or in more familiar notation, t prime is gamma times t minus vx over c squared. X prime is gamma times x minus vt. And y prime equals y, z prime equals z. And terminology, when you want to talk in terms of this zeta, this is called the rapidity or the boost parameter. I guess you'll see both terms used. Okay, so we've got our first goal accomplished. We've got our Lorentz transformation. Next time we'll talk about four vectors, and it will be hard to have more fun than that. Don't forget, you have, I think, some homework due on Wednesday.